This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
In Bangladesh, Hindus remain under siege, caught in a storm of arson, fear and intimidation amid political turmoil. Join me, Sahar Zand, as I uncover their fight for survival and justice in a nation on the brink.
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we'll be hearing what happens now in Sao Tome and Principe after the president fired the prime minister, ostensibly for not doing his job properly. And as South Africa faces chronic water shortages, we'll be holding the water ministry to account for a failure to provide consistent services across the country.
We have to admit that certain decisions were not made by those who are supposed to make the decision. But currently, as we speak, as a Ministry of Water and Sanitation, we are working with the provincial government of Gauteng so that at least they can be able to build more infrastructure. They are working together so that at least they can turn around the situation. And I'm very pleased that we're starting to see the results.
First, we go to Benin. The country is in shock after a surprise attack on the main army base in the north. The army hasn't stated fatality figures yet, but they were high enough to embarrass and anger the chief of staff of the National Guard. Benin is one of the states affected by an Islamist insurgency in the Sahelian states. The Beninois army is said to be well equipped with heavy weaponry, drones and a device to report enemy action. So how did they fail to see this attack coming? The BBC's Paul Njie told me more about the attack and the official response from Colonel Faizu Gomina, the head of the army.
Definitely, he is angry, Colonel Faizu Gomina. When the attack happened, he put out a statement really urging commanders to take the security of the nation seriously, because just on Monday, he had given them a forewarning about the need to boost military tactics and not just be content in the fact that they've got up-to-date military equipment. Recently, the U.S. gave them consignment of weapons. And so he said that, yes, we've got the weapons, but you've got to also maximize military strategy. And barely 2 days after that attack happened, so to him, it was a really big security breach. Basically, he's now saying that the commander should sit up, should wake up and focus on the need to defeat the attackers.
Who are the attackers? Do we know?
Well, not specifically. Different groups operate in northern area of the Sahel, but also in certain parts of West Africa. And these jihadist groups have links with the Islamic State and also Al-Qaeda. So there are suspicions that these groups could have come from these other countries and staged that attack in Benin. But of course, Benin has been over the years hit by attacks in its northern region from jihadist groups. But no specific group has claimed responsibility so far for that attack.
And what's the latest on the figures, you know, the fatalities and so on?
Right. So the Beninese army did not specify how many people exactly were killed in that incident. But media reports suggest that about 28 people were killed. And the opposition party, the Democrats, say about 30 were killed in the attack. But the government has, you know, refrained from providing a specific figure, perhaps not to demoralize the troops. But it's some form of a trend we're seeing not only in Benin, but in other neighboring countries where once there is an attack, they seldom provide actual figures because they know that perhaps if the figure is too high, then it might now get, you know, the other troops worried. And also, but national opinion would now become concerned about the military's capacity and efficacy in handling these security threats.
So these are soldiers we're talking about, right, that would have been in this attack because it was on a military post.
Exactly. And it's one of the strongest and most equipped military posts in northern Benin. That's why you see the chief of staff was very furious. They had the equipment. They had an internet device that could send signals for, you know, if there was an emergency and then perhaps was need for reinforcement, that could have sent the signal. They also had drones. They had all sorts of tactical weapons. But unfortunately, they still lost soldiers in that attack.
So what does this tell us, either about the level of military preparedness in Benin or the strength of whichever armed group had actually carried out this attack?
Well, I think it's a growing concern for Benin, but also for the region across West Africa. And if there's one thing we've noticed, it's that it's the growing trend of jihadist groups wanting to expand across the region. They want to expand beyond the Sahel, heading towards countries like Benin, Togo, Ivory Coast, and also in parts of Ghana. So on the one hand, some people would argue that it is on the strength of these jihadist groups, but also some would question the tactical preparedness of the different militaries of these countries. And, you know, Benin just recently in December there was another attack in, I think, the northeast, where 3 soldiers were killed, 4 others were injured. And that was bringing into question the capacity of the military or the army to handle these security threats. But of course, the military leadership is trying to give the impression that they have what it takes to quell or repel these attacks, but then they've just got to be alert and work on a strategy that would be, you know, reliable.
Do you think that this was a kind of a response to what the chief of staff of the National Guard had said about their level of preparedness, that they were, this was a riposte in a way to say, well, you know, we can strike you whenever we want to and wherever we want to, in fact, in your strongest points?
Well, you never know. But if there's one thing we've seen with the jihadist groups in the region, it's that they try to prove a point that they are in control and they've got the capacity to expand wherever they feel that their dominance could be implanted. So it could be as a response to what the chief of staff said, but it also could just be one of those planned attacks. And it coincidentally happened when the chief of staff made that statement. But I think that now what we might see is some level of alertness on the part of the Beninese army. Perhaps they might be counter-offensives. We never know. We just have to wait and see what the future would look like.
And what about the next steps? I mean, you've just said that there may be a counter-offensive, but will they need to bolster, you know, other points, or is everybody braced to see whether or not the militants strike again?
I don't think the government would be waiting for another attack to boost military presence in the area. If anything, they would be more conscious of the need to, you know, reinforce security. But like we say, sometimes military strategy is beyond what we see with our eyes or hear with our ears. I would imagine from a personal standpoint that this attack has sent a lesson to the Beninese army, and there might be reinforcements in the area anytime soon.
That's Paul Njie. Things were looking a bit sticky in Sao Tome and Principe when the president fired the prime minister and then set a deadline for the ruling party to propose a replacement. That happened on Monday, and the deadline was yesterday. Everyone was on tenterhooks. What if the ruling party proposed the same man, Patrice Trovoada, as the candidate? He does, after all, come from a powerful political dynasty. President Carlos Villanova had accused him of failing to provide solutions to the economic and financial challenges the island nation faces. Mr. Trovoada hit back, saying his sacking was unconstitutional. So what's been happening? Dr. Alex Vines leads the Africa program at Chatham House, and he's been keeping an eye on events.
Well, the deadline passed and the party of government has issued a statement. So that's the Independent Democratic Action Party, ADI. They are going to appoint the justice minister, whose name is Ilza Maria dos Santos Amadovaz, as the new prime minister. In fact, there's been a presidential decree also from President Carlos Villanova on this. So this particular crisis seems to have now been resolved in that the ADI has found somebody else to be prime minister.
Is it resolved, though? Because I'm wondering, was the president's action on January the 6th within the constitution? Was it within his rights to do what he did?
Yeah, yes. I mean, he can do that. I mean, there is kind of articles that he can follow that. And so the decree is, what I can see, legitimate. The way that it works in Sao Tome on this sort of situation is, if the party had provided Mr. Patrice Trovoada's name again, and that wasn't acceptable, then the president could turn to the second largest party to see if it can form a government. And if it couldn't do that, then they would need to go to legislative elections. I mean, legislative elections at the moment are only scheduled for 2026 in Sao Tome. And what's unusual in politics in Sao Tome at the moment is that the ADI has a majority in parliament. Often there are large coalitions that have to be sewn together, and you can have a president who's of a different party from the prime minister. And so the politics is a little bit different.
The prime minister has said he intends to lodge an appeal against his, you know, expulsion, as it were. So yeah. Can he still go ahead with that?
I mean, I guess he can still challenge it, but his party that has a kind of aligned and decided that they will move on from this. So there'll be a bit of a tug of war. I mean, the roots to this, the official reason is a dispute over taxes related to the airport, where the president had provided an overriding political veto as head of state on a tax increase, which the prime minister had wanted. I have a suspicion that the backdrop to this is actually that Mr. Trovada, the former prime minister, now I suppose is how we describe him, had aspirations to change the constitution and turn the Sao Tome political system into a presidential one. Because at the moment you have an elected president, and Carlos Villanova was elected in the last elections with 58%, but you then have an elected prime minister. Two, there are a variety of different opinions of whether a centralized, overpowerful presidency is what Sao Tome actually needs. It has a tradition of coalition politics, dialogue, redistribution, and big person politics.
Well, the president, in his statement in which he announced the firing of the prime minister, spoke about frequent and prolonged absences of the prime minister and various other failings. But what I'm wondering is, where does the real political power actually lie in Sao Tome?
It is a hybrid place. I mean, I've been to the country a number of times and worked both with the presidency and with the prime minister's office. This is one of the smallest countries in the world and very international development reliant, you know, small agricultural base. But within that, there is a vibrant culture of debate and discussion. The politics is quite incestuous, so people do move around different parties. So none of this is really particularly unusual for Sao Tome.
What I'm wondering is, the president also said that the prime minister, former prime minister, had failed to provide solutions to, you know, the economic and financial challenges and the social issues that arise from a country in financial difficulty. Just explain to us those difficulties and whether or not the new prime minister will be able to address it.
Sao Tome and Principe has become exceedingly debt burden. So over 43% of debt burden now. The lion's share of it, if that's the word to use for Sao Tome, is to kind of Equatorial Guinea and Angola. So they have significant debts that they have accrued and have been kind of very reliant on borrowing money in the past. They did make progress in December with a new extended credit facility agreement with the IMF. So they have a kind of IMF program to help them. I think the president probably has over-exaggerated the kind of the shortcomings of the Trovada period as prime minister, in that the IMF deal was a really important one. But it is true that Mr. Trovada sees himself as a grand person and was traveling a great deal.
Tell us a little bit more about Sao Tome. It used to be unstable, lots of coups and so on, but things seem to have leveled out in the last 10 years or so. What happened?
Well, it is a kind of vibrant democratic country. There was an allegation of a coup attempt a couple of years ago in November 2022, if I remember right. I published about it and got heavily criticized by Sao Tomenses for describing it as a possible coup. They said it was more about a couple of drunken individuals and a dispute that was taking place in Sao Tome, and it was never about taking over the state. But you're right, in recent years, it's been a much more stable country politically. The country is very anxious to attract new investment. It shifted its recognition from Taipei, Taiwan to China. That brought in a little bit more investment. It still dreams that it can have a deep shore offshore port that would bring in money and could help provide services to kind of Central and Southern Africa. And there's also still a dream of hydrocarbons. But really, the mainstay of the economy is primarily agriculture. Some of the best chocolate in the world is from Sao Tome. I do recommend your listeners if they see a bar of Sao Tome chocolate, I'm unashamedly advertising it. It's very yummy and delicious.
Well, I'll be on the lookout for that now. Now, are we able to draw a line under this, shall we say, crisis that unfolded this week and seems to be over with the appointment of a new prime minister? Or is it the beginnings of ructions, shall we say?
Yeah, we'll have to see. I mean, the Trivadas don't go away. I mean, they're one of the big families that kind of throw a shadow over politics ever since independence, you know. And so we'll see. But the difference this time is that the ADI does have a majority, not an absolute majority in Parliament. It's one seat short of an absolute majority. Its majority actually comes from a coalition with some other parties also. Everybody's related to each other. Sao Tome Nancy's joke, the STP, is which Sao Tome and Principe stands for Somos Todos Primos, that we're all cousins, you know. So
that's funny.
You know, there are always ways to find resolution here in, you know, one of the smallest states of the world.
Dr. Alex Vines from Chatham House. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
For just as long as Hollywood has been Tinseltown, there have been suspicions about what lurks behind the glitz and glamour.
Concerns about radical propaganda in the motion pictures.
And for a while, those suspicions grew into something much bigger and much darker.
Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I'm Una Chaplin, and this is Hollywood Exiles. It's about a battle for the political soul of America, and the battlefield was Hollywood.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
If you've been listening to Focus on Africa in recent months, you'll have heard us talk a lot about the chronic water shortages across South Africa. Just yesterday, we spoke to a water specialist and a very, very frustrated resident of Johannesburg about the difficulties of living without a consistent supply of water. It doesn't just affect individuals, it affects the economy. The Gauteng region, where Johannesburg is, houses many of the mines and farms that power South Africa's economy, which, remember, is one of the biggest on the continent. The problems stretch back to 2017, when Cape Town, a top tourist destination, nearly ran out of water. In Durban, the main domestic tourism destination, had its fair share of problems with sanitation, with beaches polluted by untreated sewage. And then there are the tragic events, mercifully fewer now, of children drowning in pit latrines because their schools don't have proper sanitation. We thought that instead of just reporting on the causes and difficulties of life without water, we should put these issues to the Ministry of Water and Sanitation. We were able to talk to Deputy Minister David Mahlobo about why the government is not better able to provide reliable water and sanitation.
You see, Audrey, government has not been sitting on its laurels. We have to admit that certain decisions were not made by those who are supposed to make the decision. But currently, as we speak, as a Ministry of Water and Sanitation, we are working with the provincial government of Gauteng, and we are also working with all the municipalities at three different levels, so that at least they can be able to build more infrastructure. We have also brought in experts, like water experts that worked in Cape Town to deal with the situation of day zero, in what we call it a water secure platform for Gauteng, working with the Development Bank of Southern Africa, the World Bank, and all these other people. They are working together so that at least they can turn around the situation. And I'm very pleased that we're starting to see the results. Because if we have chosen as a new ministry, we came in and we don't insist on these issues that they must be implemented by municipalities, the situation can become dire.
The situation, Minister, for very many people is dire. There are so many people in South Africa, in townships, informal settlements around South Africa, and schools that still have no waterborne sanitation. My mother lives in Klipspruit West. It is surrounded by very many different forms of housing, informal settlements and so on. They have been having problems with water for several years now, not just recently. This is in Gauteng province. We've been reporting regularly about children falling into pit latrines because there's no water. There's no waterborne sanitation. And that's in various parts of the country. It's not just in Gauteng. The issue that I'm driving at is that water and sanitation has been an area that the South African government has not quite delivered on for all its peoples.
You know what, Audrina? I grew up in water. I'm a water professional. The country does not want to underplay that water is an emotive issue. But equally, to paint a picture that nothing has happened, it will be incorrect. The numbers issued by the official organization that issues statistics, Stats SA, is the one that we're actually using it in terms of access or no access. There are areas in South Africa that people actually have an intermittent water supply, and there are still communities that don't have water. But we can't generalize because I know the entire country. I travel. Let's make an example about your area where you say your mother is staying. If your mother used to have water yesterday, and today your mother doesn't have water, these are the people that when it comes to reliability of availability of water, 365 days per year, is affected. And what is being affected is the very same matter we are raising, that there is an informal settlement. The informal settlement, what they've done illegal connections. When they've done those illegal connections, over a period of time, those communities that were getting water, then the supply is going to be disrupted because the flow is going to be very low. That executive mayor of Johannesburg, that's why when he took a decision to say that the communities that have used to have water must have water, let's actually deal with the issues of illegal connections. When it deals with the issues of illegal connection, they say it's wrong. Because if we don't deal with illegal connection, the people like your mother that used to have water, her right to have access to water is being violated. But equally, the municipality, because your mother would have paid if she got water, but also these ones who are stealing water, if you don't deal with it, that municipality will have no revenue. That revenue that must be used for operation and maintenance, payment of rainwater, but also building new infrastructure. The very same problem around sanitation, we know that the statistics have moved sanitation access to 84% in South Africa, but there are still communities who don't have decent sanitation, like in schools, which the Minister of Education is saying that's what she's doing. But in our own report we've produced, called the Green Drop Report about the effluent, a number of wastewater systems are overflowing because someone never planned in the local government sphere to ensure that the extra load of this development must be catered. And if you have not expanded, like the problem that happened in Royval, then it starts to cause pollution.
Yes,
and the issues of water pollution is the one that we're also saying it must be dealt with, because polluters must be charged. And then they must be able to be in a position to pay. But at the very same time, municipalities must do more and get more resources to actually build more wastewater treatment system, but also sanitation facilities that even if they are not, they are non-sewered.
People have been talking about this, obviously, for quite a while now, and they are seething with anger. In fact, I am quoting somebody that we interviewed earlier when she said that people are really frustrated, really angry, seething with anger about this, because they also point to corrupt practices to do with water supply. For instance, when the water tankers are meant to come along, they don't come. So how do you plan on dealing with that issue?
Corruption is a matter that must be dealt with without any fear of favor or prejudice.
So we're asking, and how are you dealing with it?
Let me respond, Audrey, because you raise a number of issues. In terms of national government, when it comes to issues of water cutting, national government does not want water cutting to be used by municipality as a permanent feature. It must be a temporary measure in instances where there's an interruption. And our preference as national government is that because it has an ability of being vulnerable and exploited by through collusion between those who are cutting private users, including certain employees, we want municipalities to buy themselves those particular cuts. In certain instances, you will find that they are not properly managed. They claim that they've delivered water, when they have not delivered water. Sometimes they sell the water when they are not supposed to sell the water. But at the very same time, you know, in KwaZulu-Natal, in eThekwini, certain people have been killed on the basis of cutting, including the vandalism of infrastructure. But as a policy measure, therefore, municipalities are starting to procure them. When they are actually managing them, they need to start to communicate. The issues around for people that are working in the water sector, whether they are skilled or not, there are many people who are skilled. Many engineers, both in our own department, in a number of municipalities. But I must admit, there are certain municipalities that have appointed people without the requisite skill, because water is a science, it's an engineering. To manage an asset, you have to have the requisite know-how. Those are the ones that were very clear when we're working with cooperative governance in traditional affairs, that there should never be any interference about how people must be appointed, including those who are working in the system. They must go for recognition of prior learning in the next 3 years so that we can professionalize the people who are actually managing water sector.
How do you deal with a water crisis in your house, in your household, if you're living in Gauteng?
We are all belonging to one municipality or the other. An example that I stayed in Pretoria, in Waterkloof, at a particular point, I had an incident where the municipality could not provide water to all of us as residents for 10 days. My daughter had to call me. She's at school. She says she wants to talk to me, not as a father, as a deputy minister. One of the things that I had to do was to hold local government accountable. Citizens must never stop to hold us accountable in terms of water delivery. But then I had to speak to the leadership of the municipality in our own area that they introduce more reservoirs. And I'm staying in a high-lying area as an example. When the water level was very low, then we had to be in a position to ensure that they are putting more additional pump stations. But then I've stopped irrigating my garden using raw water that is clean. But at the very same time, we also do rainwater harvesting.
So you don't have lots of 5-gallon plastic bottles around your house the way my mother does and other people have?
There are times when I have to go and buy water too, because it affects all of us. It doesn't say that because you are in the ministry, you are not going to be affected. But what I'm very happy now is that at least there is a commitment to do something about the problem. And I can see municipalities are doing something. There are still gaps. But at the very same time, there is a responsibility of every citizen around their relationship between us and water. Because we remain a water scarce country. How we actually treat water and how do we use water, especially those who have a drop of water, it has to change. Because if South Africans are using 273 liters per person per day, when the world average, they are using 173, that behavior, it has to change. But it's an inconvenience. That's why I do appreciate that people are agitated. But when their problems are reported, government must have a capacity to respond and respond timelessly.
Deputy Minister of Water and Sanitation, David Mahlobo. Focus on Africa was pulled together by the heroic work of Amy Leibovitz, Yvette Twagira-Maria, and Sunita Nahar. Patricia Whitehorn was the senior journalist in charge of all these Trojan efforts. Frank McQueenie was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudenge are our editors. In Africa Daily, our sister pod, Victoria Uongunda, is discussing what's next for Mozambique now that presidential challenger Venancio Mondlane is back in the country after fleeing during violent protests to have him declared the winner of recent elections. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.
What do Tiger Woods, Mark Zuckerberg, and Taylor Swift all have in common? Well, their lives and fortunes are all being discussed on Good Bad Billionaire, the podcast exploring the minds, motives, and the money of some of the world's wealthiest individuals. I'm Zing Sing, and each week my co-presenter Simon Jack and I take a closer look at the world's mega rich, and we try to decide whether they're good, bad, or just another billionaire. From celebs and CEOs to sports stars and tech titans, find out how billionaires made their money and how they use it. Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service. All episodes of Season 1 and 2 are available now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts. And click follow or subscribe so you never miss a new episode.